Retina Rounds podcast number 6. For our latest podcast, Retina Rounds welcomes Dr. Naresh Mandava, chair of the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Colorado. Over the past 18 years under Dr. Mandava's leadership, the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Colorado has seen immense growth, including the building of the Sue Anschutz Rogers Eye Center and the expansion of their clinician scientist faculty to being one of the largest and most innovative faculty in the country. In this episode, Dr. Mandava talks about his roots and mentors, how they inspired him to build a culture of excellence and innovation in his department, and he also provides many pearls to junior retina specialists on how they can reach their potential and deal with setbacks. Let's check it out.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Retina Rounds podcast. Today, we're thrilled to have as our guest, Naresh Mandava, one of the top surgeons in vitreoretinal surgery in the United States and certainly one of the great academic chairs in Colorado. Naresh, welcome to Retina Rounds and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
It is a great pleasure. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came into ophthalmology and vitreoretinal surgery?
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity, and it's really great to be here today. Yeah, I was very fortunate. I was to have some phenomenal mentors as a medical student. I was a med student at Albany Medical College. I was in the six-year medical program, and John Simon was the chair there and a pediatric ophthalmologist, and I did some research with him, and actually in pediatric ophthalmology and in grading acuities and visual acuities. And I really enjoyed that and was initially going to do neurosurgery and really loved the microscopic surgery, as well as the opportunity to potentially change people's lives through, you know, your hands. And that I gravitated, I think, naturally towards retina because of that love for microsurgery and really dealing with complex issues. So I was fortunate to be in a great environment with great mentors and was fortunate to match at Manhattan Eye and Ear, where I was a resident, and then followed that with training with Larry Yannuzzi and Stanley Chang, which was a great team to learn from as well.
Well, I would say those are two of the best possible mentors a person could have. Tell me what it was like working with Stanley.
Well, Stanley's a gem. He's like a big brother to me. I'd say he's like a father, but, you know, I'm getting closer. I'm getting older, so I can't say he's like a father. But he's clearly had the most influence on my sort of path as a surgeon, as well as my path as eventually as a chair of ophthalmology. I think the things I learned from Stan are, you know, always put the patient first. And we've learned that, all of us have learned that from many of our mentors. And I think he exemplifies that in a very special way. And it actually reverberates all the way into his hands when he's in the operating room thinking about how to give a patient the best chance to see. And I think the best example of that is how he tackled proliferative vitreoretinopathy. If you look at the way he, and I had the opportunity to spend a full year with him every week in the OR, sometimes 12 to 14 hours a day. But the way that he would focus on each area of the retina and give every patient the best chance to have the best outcome, I think was something that really changed the way I look at everything, whether it's, you know, clinic flow or getting better access for patients into clinics. I mean, I think that Stan's dedication to each patient, one patient at a time, is sort of the mantra that I've lived by, and that comes from him.
That's a great gift that he shared with you. Let's just talk a little bit about that, being in the OR with Stanley. All these exciting innovations were just coming to fruition while you were there. Wide angle viewing in the OR. Many of our listeners can't even fathom what a contact lens, irrigating contact lens, microscopic view of the the macula was like when we were operating on retinal detachments and PBR back in the day. And when Stanley worked with Avi to get that wide angle contact lens 2015 view for 360 or for fluorocarbon liquids and so many other things. But expound for us on, I'm sure you remember some really wild cases with Stanley, but even a more routine case when you really saw him bit by bit, considering the things you were just mentioning, each part of the retina. Talk us through that just a little bit, if you can.
Absolutely. I think I was fortunate to train in a time where, liquid fluorocarbons, many people were using liquid fluorocarbons, but we still, we're getting cases from all over the world, complex PVR, often monocular patients, often, people in the prime of their lives with just one eye with, hand motion vision. And, if you could give them count fingers vision or 2400 vision, it could change the, the trajectory of their entire end of their entire life. So I remember each of those cases were the dedication was to removing every little bit of membrane everywhere. And then time was time, we would be in the OR sometimes for 15, 16 hours and then go get Chinese food afterwards. So there was a sort of a Zen-like approach with Stan. There was no like ups and downs and emotion through those clinical days, those surgical days. There was a steadiness that I kind of learned from, and I tried to transport that steadiness into everything that I do, whether it's in the clinic or in the OR or managing research team, et cetera. I think there's a and there's a durability that he has that I think is second to none. And I've tried to exemplify that. I think the things that I, the cases that I remember, there was one case of a patient from Israel, about a 18, 17-year-old kid with one eye, retinal detachment, an atopic kid with, really bad PVR in his only eye. And, that was a 3.5 hour case, and patient had already had multiple surgeries. But I remember very well, and it was one of the first cases I did with Stan, and so I didn't do a lot of the case. I did some of the case, but at the end of the case, I closed the eye and closed the conjunctiva. And this atopic kid, the next day had his conjunctiva wasn't approximated, to each other, and some of it was, covering the cornea, and some of the sutures had, were loose, and they came out. And he basically taught me to own the patient because he said, this is a self-pay patient. Find a place where you can close this and figure out how to, how to make this look better. And what that taught me was it taught me that even as a fellow, you're responsible for every aspect of your patient. And it also taught me that get it right, right? Like when you close the conj, get it right. Don't be sloppy. It's not just conjunctiva. And every aspect of the surgery matters, right? From the beginning to the end, the positioning of your sclerotomies, the orientation of how you position your the head, how you position your body, everything matters and it all builds up. And if you mess up, fix it, right? And that accountability make you do it right the first time. And he had a way of doing that in a nice way. He never yelled. He said, "Yeah, you'll take care of this," and so you just took care of it. So that was something that I'll never forget.
It makes me smile to hear Stanley imparted to a lot of us that a fanaticism about every last detail of the case and the conjunctival closure. As I think about some of the people that we've shared in their training and now work for you, can recount stories of my semi-insane fixation on getting the conj perfect. Of course, back in those days, we opened the conj a lot more frequently than we do now. Nuresh, what about Larry Yanuzi, one of my great heroes, and just he's forgotten more than any of us will ever know, and he's still smarter than all of us. But tell me what it was like working with Larry.
I think Larry and Stan are so different, but they're so similar in that, questioning why, and I think that, if you see something and it doesn't fit, or all of us get referrals, and it says, this patient has macular degeneration, and often they don't have macular degeneration, right? And figuring out, even in an era before genetics and before the potential for gene therapies and therapeutics, this era of being inquisitive about what is going on in every aspect of the retina. And Larry Nussey, was the consummate clinician and thinker when it came to thinking about the origins of an issue and trying to pull together, all the patients in his repertoire and figure out, what was actually happening with the patient. And I think my love for retina and medical retina comes from Larry, in terms of his passion for the diseases and their pathophysiology. And ultimately, it's for the patient. It does matter that it's not just macular degeneration, because when you're looking at a 45-year-old and you're trying to figure out where they're going to end up, in this era, it's intuitive, right? Because there may be a gene therapy or something for them, but outcomes are driven by what disease that patient has, and they deserve that sort of rigor in figuring out the origins of their disease and the potential trajectory of their disease. I think pattern recognition was a Larry thing, and for me, Larry was the master of oration, and is still. His ability to captivate a room, it's a lot like you, Steve, in terms of your approach to speaking and bringing people together. And I think that's something that I'll never forget. I think a lot of my skills as a chair come from both Stan and Larry. And Larry's ability to captivate a room and command a room and bring people together around a common topic is second to none, as we all know. He still does it today.
He does, and they're both geniuses. They're both highly, highly accomplished. They've both made major contributions and given back, and you're lucky to be able to call them both mentors. I want to go to one other mentor of yours, if you're willing to tell us a little bit about your father, who our listeners won't know. Total genius. And share a little bit, if you're willing to.
Yeah, of course. My father, who is no longer with us, passed away about almost 10 years now. His name was Babu Mandava, and Babu was an immigrant to the United States in the early 60s, was an engineer, and did three master's degrees in the United States after he came here. And he was one of the first Indians, I think, if in the island of Manhattan. There were probably four or five of them in the early 60s that were part of that first immigration pool to the United States. And my father went on to have a prolific career at IBM, and then followed by starting his own company, a software staffing type company. He was awarded the Ellis Island Medal, and was recognized for that, along many other very proud Americans. And so that was a special day for us. He just gotten a diagnosis of cancer, and it happened the next month, which was just fortuitous in timing that we were all able to be there with him. But I think the things I've learned from my dad are really the culture, I think, that we've built in the department is built on his belief that everybody in an organization is important. Some of them are introverts, some of them are extroverts, some of them are great at science, some of them are great clinicians. If you took a biopsy of our department, it would reflect that each individual is valued and is pushed and is inspired, I should say, not just pushed, but inspired to be the best that they can be and to elevate the people around them, right? Because that's the key to success, whether you're in a private equity, retina practice, or you're in academic practice, or in your own practice, the ability to each of us should be judged by how we elevate the people around us, how we make them better, right? And that's how you get the most out of everybody. And my dad was particularly strong at that. He was also a very proud American, and I think wanted all of us to join the military, and none of us did. I did apply to for ROTC, but didn't get in. But he was particularly disappointed about that. But he was an interesting guy. He was an immigrant, and obviously lived in the U.S. for most of his life. But was very proud of the opportunities that that this country gives each and every one of us. And I think I'm the young, as the youngest of five, I would say all of us have embraced those opportunities and tried to really pass those opportunities forward. No matter what your background is, I think, there's an opportunity in America to make it, to make a, an impact and to be the best you can be. And so I think you have a similar story, Steve. So,
yeah, well, it's a universal one, but it's really amazing how you have the three legs of the stool that have led you to this incredible platform of who you've become and what you've built. And so tell us a little bit about the Eye Center in Denver and where it was when you got there and where it is now.
Well, yeah, thanks for giving me the chance to do that. Yeah. So I've been fortunate to be chair here for about 18 years. So I've had a long runway and been very supported by our institution. I've had the opportunity to raise the dollars necessary to build a large academic enterprise. We have a little over 80 faculty in the department. I think some of the areas that I think we've excelled, we have depth in every division. For example, our pediatric ophthalmology group, we have 10 pediatric ophthalmologists in that group, many pediatric optometrists as well, probably one of the largest, if not the largest, pediatric ophthalmology group in the country. And, we just hired our 10th retina specialist in the retina division on the adult side. And I think the way we've been able to bring together the adult and the pediatric eye care to be second to none, I think we're super proud of. Some of the differentiators, I think, for us are the innovation environment we've created. There's at least 13 technologies that have been licensed to companies from the department. Hundreds of, well over hundreds of millions of dollars raised by venture capital from startup companies in the department. And we've created this innovation environment led by people like Malik Kahook, who are focused on, pushing their ideas forward, getting to no-go decisions early, and then supporting those people to realize their goal of bringing technologies to patients, right? And so we think that academic departments are critical in this in the realm of innovation to bring new technologies to patients. And oftentimes that involves partnerships with industry, whether it's device or pharma. But our focus has been on pushing those technologies forward as far as we can before they're licensed out to industry. For example, the Kahook dual blade was pioneered in the department. The research was done by Malik Kahook and pushed all the way through human clinical trials that were sponsored by the department. And there was a direct license to industry. And I think academic departments need to figure out how to do that, as we have pressure from NIH funding. All of the pressures that you know about, Steve, in academic medicine that put academic medicine at risk. And we need to participate in not only bringing new technologies to patients, but in the financial rewards that come from that, because that's where we get the next dollars to support innovation. And so I think we've differentiated ourselves in the department in that realm with several technologies that are in clinical use today, including the Kahook dual blade. I think some of the other things I'm proud of in the department are our research centers of excellence in stem cell technologies and artificial intelligence, led by leaders like Valcanto Solar and Jayashree Kalpathy Kramer, who's the head of AI. Jayashree was recruited. She was the head of imaging AI at Harvard Mass General, and radiology developing systems and mammography and CT and things like that. And we brought her into ophthalmology to focus on developing the systems we all know we need to take care of our patient population, right? With our shortage of eye surgeons in the U.S., I would argue a lot of risk in terms of access for patients. We need to do better and develop systems to really standardize the way we image patients, get readings for patients, elevate mid-level providers to be able to even provide the care that's necessary to know where those patients get triaged, right? And I think that's the only way that we're going to be successful in taking care of a population. And as a department, I think last comment, I think that's one of the awesome things about academic medicine, you know, the opportunity to make an impact. And I think AI will be a big area. And then, you know, obviously the educational aspects. I mean, you've been an educator your whole life and trained hundreds of fellows and residents. And I think that's a critical part of what we do. It's an unfunded part of what we do, but it's critical for the future of our field. And as we have, you know, this huge gap in the supply and demand of eye care in this country, we need to train our new residents and fellows to be leaders in solving that problem, where we can't have 50% of glaucoma patients, only 50% of patients with glaucoma in the United States know they have glaucoma. Only 50% of patients with diabetes get diabetic retinopathy screening. These numbers are abysmal, right? And we're not going to solve that by just doing more injections. We're going to have to figure out how to solve that issue. And I think academic medicine and private medicine, you know, many of our thought leaders are in the private sector. They're the ones that are going to, we're the ones that are, all of us together are going to be the ones that find solutions for that. And I see that as a big role of our department.
That's fantastic, Naresh. Now, one thing that a lot of our listeners won't know, I think they're stunned to learn the size of the department. Talk to us just briefly about your catchment area. Like, you know, for our international listeners, this is a regional center just about right in the middle of the United States, but tell us about your encashment. Where do you draw patients from? Not globally, but just domestically.
So I'd say in every division, whether it's ocular inflammation, retina, pediatric ophthalmology, tumors, we get patients every day from 8 or 9 states. Because if you look at the map, we're the only academic eye center from Canada to Mexico, north and south. I mean, New Mexico has a small, nice eye center, University of New Mexico. And then Salt Lake City and Kansas City and St. Louis to the east of us. It's a growing region. You know, our population historically has been growing at 100,000 people a year in Colorado. But if you look at that entire catchment area, in the time that I've come here, over 25 years, that population is well over doubled.
Well, maybe we can blame you for that population, Bill.
I don't think so. I think it's the weather. It's just beautiful here, you know, and I think with that energy and that opportunity, we don't see it just as an opportunity in terms of size. And obviously one of the largest eye departments in the country, but I think we've seen it as a responsibility. So if you take a field like neuro-ophthalmology, you know, there's 5 neuro-ophthalmologists in the state of Colorado that are practicing neuro-ophthalmologists, and all 5 of them are in the department. So it's an interesting dynamic when you think about it. It's not just an opportunity, it's a responsibility. There's not a lot of competition in a lot of these spaces, but there's a great responsibility. But with that, I think the cool thing is that we've been able to leverage that huge patient database to build these AI tools and to actually attract top talent, right? Like if you're a neuro-ophthalmologist like Prem Subramanian, you want to study a rare disease in neuro-ophthalmology, you want to be in a place where you're going to have the patient population to do that. And now with our electronic systems and Jayashree leading, we're able to mine 10 years of EMR and imaging data at our fingertips, you know, all HIPAA compliant, all, you know, IRB approved with, you know, silos of who can access glaucoma data related to a specific question. And I think that's only been possible, Steve, because of that huge infrastructure we've created in terms of, you know, our faculty see well over 200,000 patients a year. So, and that's what created that opportunity, I think, to build these systems.
I could tell you, Naresh, this is all so impressive, but it's not the most impressive part about your department. The most, especially retina, which I know well, the most impressive part of your department are the people that you've hired by far. And I would just like you to generalize it, not that you hired, but also that you train. And for our listeners, I've had the opportunity to share a number of people with Naresh in terms of different parts of their career. And the Colorado people are universally exceptional. What our listeners want to know, especially our young listeners who are coming up, is what does someone like you look for in an applicant, whether it's a fellowship applicant or a faculty applicant? And then what do you, everybody looks for something different, right? But what is it for you that you're, look, table stakes are everybody's smart. There's nobody gets to think about going on to a faculty or going on to a retina fellowship or even ophthalmology if they're not smart. So everybody's smart. Everybody's accomplished. So what is it? What are the features that you're looking for that make them a good fit for you? You've built, well, I think one of the incredible statistics is nobody leaves, right? I mean, it's a kudos to you. You're a great leader and a great mentor to people, and you create a fantastic environment. You've obviously got a super dynamic department. But what do you look for in people, Naresh?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Steve, I think the key, and you said it, that people are what matter. And, you know, we have such a shortage of eye surgeons in this country that the people that we train, you know, are gems, right? Like we need them to be exceptional, and we need to support them. And I'll tell you, in academic medicine, we need those kinds of people because they're the ones that are going to scale our ability to make an impact. So I think it starts with respect. It starts with, creating a culture for us. I think a culture that supports each individual.
But what do you look for when you're interviewing someone? Like when you go, you just filled yet another spot in the retina group. I'm sure the person you hired, I don't even know who it is. You don't have to talk about them specifically. But if you go right from the newest person to your division chief, who we know well, what is it you look for in these people? Because they're not all the same, you know? But there's got to be the Naresh Madhava secret sauce for recruiting for our listeners. They're going to be taking notes on this part of the podcast.
Steve, thanks for letting me speak about it. I think the key for us is if you're a clinician who does surgery, we need to have evidence that you have the surgical ability and gravitas to be an exceptional surgeon, because surgical outcomes are critical for a surgical eye department. And it's always hard to figure out who's a top surgeon or who can develop into a top surgeon. But I think for me, I'm looking for that. And I'm not just calling the surgical mentors. I'm calling we're calling their colleagues and others who have been in the OR with them. And I think, you know, all of us have the opportunity to be top surgeons. And so I would recommend that if you're a fellow, that you're practicing in the lab, you're really working hard to make sure that you're able to close the conjunctiva and you're not screwing up like Dr. Madhava did. That you're doing those things that are necessary even early on to be exceptional, because you've worked so hard to get here. Your surgical skills matter. Your people skills matter. Your ability to get along with others and elevate those around you. If there's not evidence that you have the ability to do that because you're overly selfish or you're thinking about yourself in any given situation, some of the thoroughbreds in our field, I call them the best of the best, sometimes don't play the best in the sandbox. But they, in my opinion, I still try to recruit those kinds of people, because I think that they can change if they come into a culture where they're highly supported and their needs are being met and they're being judged on how they elevate the people around them. They can actually change their behavior. And I've seen it time and time again. So I think those are the things I'm looking for that are key in a researcher. I'm looking for creativity and their ability to push ideas forward and execute on getting grants, on getting funding, on developing new ideas, and even clinicians that are they're doing that as well. Those things are important to me. But I think it comes with your ability to have the best outcomes for patients. And I think surgical skill is important for a surgical department. I think that's key for me.
That's really interesting, Naresh. And so let's transition away from your role as chair to your role as surgical mentor. Can you synthesize the three or four takeaway lessons that you want your fellows to come away from? What are the key principles that you're teaching your fellows in the OR? Most people who are chairs at your level, who are running such a big department, don't have a vibrant surgical and medical retina practice. You have all three. Personally, you're super busy clinically, both on the, and we'll talk a little bit about medical retina in a minute, but in the OR, you're training great fellows, and they're you've obviously got a great team of retina docs around them, but when they get a chance to be with you, I know that you respect the tissues and do everything the same way. And but for you, what is it that, what are the key principles that you're trying to impart to your fellows, besides trying to turn them into Stanley Chang, which we all do with our fellows, but isn't always the easiest thing in the world to do?
Yeah, I think, and my ability to operate and do the things I do, a lot of it is because Scott Oliver is such a great chief, and you train Dr. Oliver. He's a phenomenal retina chief, and really has led a fantastic group. I'm fortunate to be able to operate most weeks, and able to do routine cases as well as really complex cases with the fellows. And the things I really am proud of are that we're very critical on our outcomes, right? And I think, you know, this question of, does the patient benefit from a band on the eye, or, you know, is this a vitrectomy, or, you know, let's take retinal detachment, for example. Right. We had Stan Chang and I did a series in the early 2000s with Bill Schiff, where we looked at 120 consecutive cases of primary retinal detachment. Everybody had this pseudophakic detachment. Everybody had the same surgery. I think I had about 68 of them, and their group had less, like 45 or something. But we did the surgery in the same way. 41 band, vitrectomy, perfluoron gas, right? Same surgery, and it became sort of our phaco, right? Our phaco, capsulorhexis, you know, phaco, IA. It became our surgery of
Somebody named a society after it.
They did.
Yeah,
the Buckle Society. Yeah,
yeah.
And so we had 100% success rate, and we actually took just 100 and whatever consecutive cases, because the point we wanted to make was that you should standardize some of these things. It shouldn't be, you know, an investigation each time you do something. It doesn't mean you do the same exact same surgery in every patient, but their goal should be 100% outcome for our patients. And some surgeries have an 82% outcome, or 89 or 92. And it's hard to say one's better than the other, but in your hands, how do you get closer to 100% outcome for your patient? And it does take 15 or 20 minutes more to put a band on the eye sometimes. But there are cases, I think, that it makes sense to do that. Maybe it's not every case, every pseudophakic case in this era with improvements in vitrectomy. And I don't put a band on every patient anymore. But to be critical about what the potential outcome could be, that, you know, we know that that there's a lot of variability in surgical outcomes. And that variability in primary retinal detachment may be from 82% to 98%.
But so I'm synthesizing your answer. You're telling your fellows, always strive to improve outcomes.
Yes.
Keep an eye on outcomes. Standardize to the extent that you can. Do things the same way. We've heard this from multiple great surgeons that we've talked to here on Retina Rounds. Do things the same way. And think about the patient before you go in the OR, while you're in the OR, and after you're in the OR, so that you can do these things. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, Yep. And the last thing I just add is visualization, right? Like there, if something is suboptimal, there's a reason for it. And if you're struggling in an area because you can't see, there's a reason for it. Fix the reason. Is it the cornea? Is there a little blood on the cornea? Is there, some debris floating around in the AC? And do it quickly, right? If you can't see, you can't fix the problem. Visualize, and then your surgical time will drop from, in a complex case, from 3 hours to 1 hour and 50 minutes on the most complex cases. If you really standardize how you do that as well, right? Get to the area, take care of the area, go to the next area. And the other piece is, when you put the vitrector in the eye, and I see a lot of people like waving it around and just kind of, and it's great that the technology is so great now that you can just do that. But do be systematic. Take care of an area. Don't go back to that area. Go to the next area. Go to the next area. Be systematic so that
Surgical
you've got.
perseveration.
Yeah, it's not gonna, when you're done with an area, go to the next area because you got seven more cases to do. So be systematic. We don't have
Efficient.
enough surgeons for you to spend too much time on any one area. We got to be the best in that area and then move to the next area. I learned that from Stan. Even though he wasn't the fastest surgeon, he was very methodical in how he did everything. And that's how he came up with all these ideas. Because every step built on the next step, and he never went back to the past step to figure out, to reinvent something he already fixed, He just kept moving.
Yeah, he knew he fixed something when he'd fixed it, and he moved on. And that was because he was systematic and engineer, methodically minded, and not altogether unlike Babu. So let me ask you this. You're in the clinic, you got your senior fellow with you, you see somebody who's 20, 30, 20, 40, phakic, very bothered by their metamorphopsia. And they've got a macular pucker. Now, that's an oversimplification. But what are the things you look at when you're considering surgery in somebody who's still highly functional in the eye? And we're seeing the envelope get pushed closer and closer to, almost perfect acuity. It's obviously not the only parameter of vision, but you're talking to your fellow and you're talking to the patient. What are the things that take you through? Not just in the patient's history and how they function, but what are you looking for on the OCT or on the exam that could sway you one way or the other to take that patient in? Because they're going to most likely have a good outcome. The chances are very low that they're going to have a complication other than maybe their cataract progressing, but they could. And when they happen, they could be catastrophic. Nobody's cavalier about taking patients into the OR. So just walk us through your thought process as you, and it's just an example, but somebody who's functioning pretty well.
I think that's a great question, and I spend a lot of time with the fellows on this. I think connecting with the patient and knowing what's really bothering them is key. And then I always check their near vision myself, because often in retina practices, the near vision isn't tested and it's not tested well. So I make sure before I shine light in their eye, I look at their OCT and check their vision one eye at a time with good lighting, to see what their reading speed looks like and to see how they're actually functioning so that we can have a dialogue on how well they're actually functioning in terms of their reading and in terms of how much this metamorphopsia is bothering them. Because sometimes when someone is told that they have something, it develops a life of their own and it's not really an issue. Versus other times, it's a tremendous issue and no one can pinpoint what the issue is. This person doesn't read anything. They're 20/30 in their left eye, but at near their J8, and they can't read anything because of the pucker. For me, that's an easy decision. They're having surgery, right? If they're J1 plus in 2025, 2030, maybe we're not doing surgery,
Even
right?
if their OCT looks terrible.
Even if their OCT looks terrible. And because I find that, and it doesn't mean I don't follow that patient to see if they turn the corner and they develop a little vitelliform, change in their outer retina. And they're going to be 20/50 in 26 months, right? We see those patients, and then I operate on those patients at 20/30 even. So I think I'm a conservative surgeon, but I probably do more 20/30 puckers than a lot of people, right? It depends to me on what your vocation is and what's bothering you, right? I've had surgeons over the years. I remember a cardiothoracic surgeon who had bilateral puckers, who was done if they didn't have bilateral surgery. So I think patient selection is key. Taking an 84-year-old who didn't have any complaints and is 20/40 in both eyes and is able to read J2 and read well with magnification, and they've had a pucker for a year and a half or two, I'm not operating on that patient, right? So I think it's but a 20/30 cardiothoracic surgeon who has distortion and has changes in the outer retina on OCT, they're having surgery. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Steve, but that's been my.
What are your OCT? Are there any signs on the OCT that really push you in a pucker patient that really push you to take the patient to the OR?
I think the way the outer retina is behaving in terms of that vitelliform change in the fovea, I think those patients end up 20/40, 20/50 in 2 or 3 years, no matter what. And I tend to operate on those. And then the configuration of, how much how disorganized the retina looks. And chronicity is important too, Steve. Like, we live in an era where electronic medical records are not robust. We can't see the images that were 4 or 5 years ago. But if I get my hands on images and the patient's 20/30 and they have chronic changes 20/40 and they look the same 4 years ago, I find those patients don't do as well versus patients that had more acute changes over the last 6 or 8 months. Doesn't mean I won't operate on someone who looks bad 2 years ago that isn't doing well. If I can point to a vision problem or a functional problem, I'll still operate on them.
Fascinating, and I'm sure the fellows really benefit from that. How about with your wet AMD treatment there in Colorado? I'm sure the volume is unspeakably large, so we won't get into that. But again, you're with the fellow, and you've got a patient with a new coronary vascular membrane, relatively good vision. Second eye, they got treated and extended in the community and step therapied in the community. They bounced around to multiple doctors. And we've all got lots of these patients where the first eye is just shot because no fault of the providers. The patients either didn't, their journey through the anti-VEGF or VEGF suppression was incomplete and they suffered for it. And now they've got a new lesion in their dominant eye. And how do you approach that patient in terms of your treatment strategy, what you tell them, what you tell the family, and what you tell the fellow?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, for a lot and to a large extent, our payers are requiring that we use Avastin in this era. I don't know if that's the case in Southern California, but we've seen that
At
transition.
least you have payers.
Yes, sir. Understood. But before that, I would say I was one of those physicians who tended not to use Avastin as much and used some of the drugs that we all enjoy using, like Eylea, that are quite effective and maybe last a little bit longer in the eye and give a better opportunity for treat and extend. But I think, my approach has been that to discuss, I always discuss with the patient the compounded drugs versus the let's just call them brand name drugs that are in the market, and then have a discussion on this concept of treat and extend. And I think that's the direction that we want to end up in, where we're treating monthly initially, but the goal is to extend these therapies. And I spend not a lot of time, but several minutes on that concept with the family involved, because I think it's important to set the framework for what this looks like over the coming years, right? Because it's not the coming weeks or months, it's the coming years. I think that's critical. And I try to teach the fellows that, because I think that's the most important part of this whole process. I'd say the other parts that are critical for me. And we can dive into drugs if you want to, and what the choices are in terms of treat and extend and getting patients out longer, which I think is a goal. I one of the keys for me is teaching the patient that this is a lifetime therapy. And if you drop off the map for this second eye, it's going to be like the other eye.
That's the key.
Yes, if you're a snowbird who's going to be in, and you and I have them, right? You're in Scottsdale, you're in Naples, you're in somewhere in Texas, wherever it is, you're going to be bouncing back and forth and you're going to make a phone call and you're not going to be able to get into one of your providers. You need to own the fact that you're getting shots every 8 weeks at that point and that you're the one responsible for it. It's not everybody else because you're going to fall through the cracks. And it's your only eye. So obviously we try not to make it hard for our patients to come in, but I think they need to own that. And then I think that the last piece that I like to teach the fellows is the way you leave the eye after the injection is going to determine maybe 75, 80% of the time whether our residents and fellows are getting phone calls at night. So, irrigating the eye at the end of the procedure and making sure that we less is more and that we do the appropriate pieces, but we don't leave the eye, miserable, so that a lot of times unavoidable. We all know that, right? But I think there's that you and I know that there's some providers that are getting a lot of phone calls every night because they're not thinking about that. And I think that's one thing that we try to teach the fellows.
Oh, that's great. Those are great tips for our listeners. So Naresh, what are as you train your fellows, what are the devices that you think in your career that have just completely changed the field? And you've already alluded to AI, so I know where your answer is going to be, but what are the next innovations? So take us through, you've been around so many sea changes. We all, in our generation, but you were right where it was happening, whether it was perfluorine in the eye, liquid perfluorocarbons in the eye with Stanley, or watching OCT come on board. I mean, I guess you were out of New York when OCT really was popularized, but what are the big innovations for you that you saw, and then predict for us what's coming down the pike, what's going to change things for us, both in the near term and the long term?
No, that's a great question. I think, let me just cut it up into imaging, then device, then drug. For me, imaging is critical, and our ability. I think obviously OCT. You and I, were there when we had the first Stratus OCTs, and then, time domain, et cetera. Right, we were there for the entire spectrum, and the ability. You and I were able to tell whether a macula had edema with a contact lens, right? And we could tell you the regions that had edema. And I tried to, I think that we've seen that technology evolve to a point that's just exceptional, right? I mean, we can see everything. But I think that there's a lot of opportunity there going forward in OCT angiography, I think is super exciting. And
Let's talk about that. Do you use OCTA angiography clinically?
I do. Yeah, we use multiple modalities there, including the Plexi-Leap Zeiss product. But I think that for me, that's my go-to in AMD patients, in even in to a large extent in diabetic retinopathy. I like to have a feel of what the vasculature looks like in the macular area. I think it's exceptional for that. And in that, let's say that monocular patient that you were talking about that's getting anti-VEGF, I want to know what the choroidal neovascular complex looks like. I want to know if it is one, right? Can I see, choroidal neovascularization coming from the choroid into the subretinal space, into the retina? A lot of times you identify these problems very early, right? And you and I see these patients that have a little intraretinal edema overlying a pigment epithelial detachment. And it's often overlooked. And then you see the patient 6 months later, and that's the area that became coronary vascularization. We should have known that 6 months ago and identified that this patient is his already developing knee vascularization. Maybe it's like a quiescent knee vascular complex, like David Guyer used to call it, but then it became active. And
Do
I
you
think
sorry for interrupting, do you use fluorescein angiography anymore?
I do. I use fluorescein angiography. I use the wide angle systems in diabetic patients because I feel like I can see, staining of the vasculature peripherally and the development of knee vascularization early in type 1 diabetics. And I have so many patients in clinic that I see were followed yearly or every 6 months, and they looked like they had no retinopathy. And then you see them with a vitreous hemorrhage, and you see that no one ever did a fluorescein angiogram on them. I think that it's quite helpful in identifying. And it's not like I take someone, I do a fluorescein every 6 months. But if you're a type 1 diabetic, you've had diabetic retinopathy for 30 years, and you look like you have poor perfusion to the retina, you in my practice, you've had an angiogram. If you look wonderful at every year, you had it every 2 years, but you've had them, and we can look back and see what you look like.
So imaging, what about other innovations? You obviously the anti-VEGF has been a sea change, the injectable pharmacologics, but what about and how about devices?
I think devices, we've had a shortage of new innovation in vitreoretinal disease, in my opinion, right? Vitreoretinal surgery is the new machines are phenomenal, right? And cut speeds are amazing, et cetera. But we're using smaller instrumentation, and sometimes when we go smaller and the instruments aren't as stiff, we lose some abilities too. So I think we've kind of hit a ceiling on a lot of the in a lot of these areas. So I'd like our young scientists to think about how we eliminate the vitreous without having to do vitrectomy, things like that that are seem impossible because of the if you study enzymatic vitreous digestion, some of the problems are the toxicity to the retina. And a lot of these things have an exothermic reaction that cause damage to the cells. But all of us should be looking at the literature and trying to figure out if there's something that we're missing, right? If we can get to Mars, then we could probably figure out that in the next decade, how to obviate the need for vitrectomy for most patients. I think that
So
would be
let's look forward. Let's look forward. You're one of the
yeah.
great. You're one of the great seers of the future, and your group has, you have a super robust regenerative medicine group, the stem cell group that you've put together. They're amazing. I've had the privilege of visiting them in the lab, and they're just stunning. The AI group is stunning, as are so many others in your department. So, without thinking in terms of your particular groups, just think about it in terms of our field. Where do you see it going? Where do you predict the next big breakthroughs? I've spent a lot of time working on AI and microsurgical robotics with JP at Horizon Surgical, and spent a lot of time with regenerative medicine and autologous RPE injections and so on. And so you know where I'm at, but where are you at? Where do you think the next big sea changes, both near term and long term? Like, what's going to change for us in the next few years that might rock our worlds, and what's going to change for us over the next 10 years or so that you think may help us?
Yeah,
Crystal ball. It's crystal ball time, Naresh.
absolutely. Like let's take something like geographic atrophy, and we could, extrapolate that to other neurodegenerative, retinal degenerative diseases. I think with over 40 companies that have pharmacotherapeutics in this space, we're going to identify much better ways of treating this disease than we have currently, and I think that's going to improve our ability to develop. And it's an overused word, but neuroprotective technologies, pharmacotherapeutics for patients with other diseases. I think that's going to happen. And what's the form factor of those? Are they monthly injections? Are they gene therapies? I think yes. I think we're going to see a lot of all of these things. And I think We should be all excited to be a part of that. I think regenerative medicine, in terms of cell replacement therapies, we're going to see some that start to work. I think the eye is a remarkable place to transplant tissue. Now, the connectivity is the question. Can we transplant photoreceptors in RPE that connect to all of the cell layers, then into nerve fiber layer? I'm optimistic. I think we can, but I think it's not going to be just stick it in there and it works. It's going to be developing the, I call them condiments, but the growth factors and neural growth factors that allow that connectivity to occur in vivo. I think some of the other areas that I'm super excited about are improvements in the OR, and your guys' work in robotics is second to none, JP and your work with him. But I think that that's exciting as a surgeon, right? That some of the things that we do that are difficult are going to get more difficult as we get into cell replacement therapies. And I think that we're going to be able to do those, replace those cells through small retinal incisions, and have, form factors for devices to deliver these cells. We have some patents around delivering, a sheet of RPE photoreceptors under the macula, and in our form factor, in Val's form factor, we have that on a synthetic membrane. But the ability to deliver that safely in a small incision, I think, is going to be interesting. Obviously, we have to solve the problem first. We need to figure out how to develop cells that actually you can transplant. But then the surgery is going to be really fun with those, right? And developing robotics around that, I think, will be smart. I'm excited about all of those things, Steve.
Great. Well, if you were talking to the medical students or the residents, which you do, I think on occasion they trot out the big guns there at the University of Colorado, probably right after the football coach. Do you look forward in our give us your outlook for our field? Like, where do you think the excitement level should be about people considering coming into retina, or when people are training, they're beaten up. There's a fellow somewhere in India or Brazil listening to this podcast, driving home after a long day in the OR with their mentor or by themselves, and or someone early in their career and they're feeling down, as we all do, and so. Share with them the pick-me-up speech when you pat your fellow on the back and pick them up, because yours is so good.
First of all, I'm so optimistic about the future of ophthalmology and eye care in general. If you think about aging population, 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 every day in the United States, we're privileged to be in this field, right? And the ability to give sight to patients, if you look at, we've been fortunate to raise over $100 million for, research and clinical care and education in the department. But the only reason we're able to do that is how precious vision is for patients. Right. If people value their vision often more than their
I
life.
disagree with you. I think the reason you've been able to do it is because people invest in the team, and you've put together a great team. So yeah,
Both. We couldn't do it without the first, right? And
right.
I think and then you look at the innovation that's happening in our field. First of all, the opportunity to take all your knowledge in medicine overall and apply it to ophthalmology, you should know the ophthalmic literature and be studying it. And that's a given, right? All of you are smarter, you wouldn't get into the field, but you should be learning what people are doing in Alzheimer's research, in cancer research, in neurosurgery, because some of those ideas you can bring to our field. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to come up with new ideas, right? Many of you are rocket scientists, but I think that most of us aren't, right? And we just have a drive and want to learn. And I always ask why. Like, I think a theme of today, Yunnuzhi, Chang, Schwartz, always ask why. And then don't be afraid to be the first to do something, right? Like someone is the first. Listen to other people. Don't invent something that someone else already invented. Like read the literature, read the patent literature too. Like, don't spend 10 years working on an idea that someone else developed 10 years ago. Learn what's already been done, and it's all at your fingertips because of technology, ChatGPT, all of the other ways that you can learn about what's already there. And that's how you develop your new ideas, right? When you know what's already there. And then work with others because you can't develop these ideas on your own. Learn from the people around you and leverage those rich environments that you're in.
Those are such inspiring words, Naresh. I'm going to now swap it over. And now the fellow is driving home after a complex surgery where they're afraid there's been a huge complication and they're just depressed. What do you say to your fellows? Everybody has complications. The eye is unforgiving. And I'm not talking about hooding of the conjunctiva and having the shocking moment where the conj is dehissed after you closed it with your superstar mentor. Talking about a real sight-threatening complication, whether it's an endophthalmitis or a hemorrhage or something really untoward. What do you tell what's your pep talk for the fellows?
Yeah, I mean, I think
Or do you tell your fellows you're done, this career, your career's over, you're out of here?
haven't had to do that yet, Steve, but I think the key is in those situations, there's the patient comes first, right? And so what is the patient going to go through here? What are the chances that we can save the eye? How do we connect with the patients and how do we see the patient? If there's a question of whether we see the patient or whether you're seeing the patient, make sure it's you seeing the patient. The person that did the surgery needs to see the patient. I would say the attending needs to see the patient if it's a fellow, and there was an attending involved. But making sure that we give the patient the best chance, right? Given something we can't change that happened, how do we look forward and make sure the patient has the best outcome possible? Whatever the technology is, anywhere in the world.
So that's a given. What are you telling the fellow about their psyche?
Terms of so we all live in our head sometimes, right? And you can't change your brain, right? Sometimes, but you can drive it in the direction that it needs to go to make the best of a situation, right? All of us will go through tragedies in our lives, and we have to reframe the reality and move forward. It's a loss, right? The patient lost their eye. We lost a part of ourselves in that process. We were involved in that. In the Mandava family, and I'd say doing this for almost 30 years now, the family knows if Naresh had a bad outcome for a patient, because I take it hard too, even today. But I'll tell you, I can reframe it and move forward in a way that I couldn't before. And I think that there is a way to do that. And what I do is I think about, what did I learn from this, and how do I make sure this doesn't happen again? Right. And that's easy to say. Hard to accomplish, right? Because it's a human that lost their eye because of something we might have avoided. Most of the time, it's not something we could have avoided, right? It's something that happened that was untoward, that wasn't because, we put an instrument through the back of the eye.
Right. It was something bad that was going to happen anyway, and you're trying to stop it and couldn't. But what I was really trying to get at, and you just said it, was it's normal to feel badly. In fact, if you don't feel badly, if you're involved in something tough, you probably shouldn't be there. It's when you lose that feeling, and that caring and that sense of responsibility. That's what we share with our fellows, and that's I've always shared, and that's what I know you do, but it's and you got it exactly right. And it's how do you learn from it? And so those are great tips for our listeners and for our young people out there. And also that they're it's as trite as it sounds, there's going to be a tomorrow, and you're going to be able to apply the lessons you learned, and you're not going to feel better unless you do everything humanly possible for the patient at hand, and that includes letting other people benefit from it.
Absolutely. And we've all had the complications, right, Steve? You and I have had them, and the young people need to
More
learn
than my share.
more than our share. And my experience has been And the complications I've had, I remember an endophthalmitis patient from an intravitreal injection, and all of us get them, and it may be one in 10,000, but I had it on a patient, and she ended up being a major donor to this organization. So, and I'm not saying that because I'm just saying that because she bought into the fact that we really did care and we did our best and we
Wasn't she
failed.
bought into it? She recognized it.
Yeah, she recognized it, and I bought into it. Sounds like
Yeah.
you're trying to sell something, but I think that I just give that example because I think you have this patient who had a bad outcome, and you and I have had these patients that have had bad outcomes, and they apologize to us for their bad outcome. Like, I'm sorry that my eye didn't behave for you, Dr. Mandava. And we feel we're heartbroken because we're like, no, it's not you.
Yeah.
We just don't have the technology to get it right. And it's on us. We need to figure out how to do this better. But I think be in it with your patient and listen to them and fight for them, and they'll recognize that and you will be better. Don't perseverate. That's the most important thing. And I think that's why you're bringing this up. Wellness is extremely important. And when you perseverate, you're letting the next patient down, right? And the patient that had a bad outcome doesn't want you to do that. It's your responsibility to figure out how to frame the situation so that you can move forward and be the best for the next 30 years of your career. And when you perseverate, it doesn't mean you're a good person because you're perseverating. You're a good person because you recognize the problem and you moved on. When you perseverate, you're hurting the next person. And it's not like you're being a martyr and you've done a great thing by perseverating. You've created a problem that didn't need to happen.
That's exactly right. Well, can I just say, Naresh Mandava, Chair at the University of Colorado Eye Center. The formal name is the Anschutz Eye Center, is that correct?
The Sue Anschutz Rogers Eye Center.
There
Yes.
you go. I always get it wrong. Sue, I'm sorry if you're listening, and you should be because you've got a great chairman. But what a privilege it is to have had you here today, sharing your thoughts and your history and your teachings. And I'm sure that our audience is going to ask to have you back because there's so much more to hear from you. And what a lucky group of people you're leading there in Colorado and nationally and internationally. It's really been a pleasure having you on today, Naresh. Thank you very, very much for participating in Retina Rounds.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.